Thank you, Anne. Our last presentation is by Bill McCarthy. He is a senior research officer, I believe. Senior researcher at the Health and Human Development Program in Los Alamitos, California. And he's going to be talking to us about influences on adolescent use of the California helpline, as we've already heard that speaker talk about.
Greetings. You already used up half my time with the questions. So here are my co-authors. We have the distinction of all being born in different countries. We in California find it easy to work internationally. I do have a disclosure statement. I have nothing to disclose. The source of the data came from a statewide survey. It's mandated every 2 years that California schools participate. It's a random selection of California schools where 6th through 12th graders are assessed in order to help us evaluate whether statewide tobacco use prevention education programs are working, and also to assess the prevalence of smoking among our young people every 2 years. And generally the trends are good, but not every year. So the most recent report that's available is this one, and If you saw my handout, it includes a link where you can get the, I think it's a 4 megabyte copy of this. And here's our nice simple model, logic model. And I just like to honor the fact that there are lots of influences on smoking, and this presentation will simply focus on cessation as a way of reducing prevalence of smoking among young people. And the question, the critical question here is, among youth who smoke, what proportion use the helpline? Why do they use the helpline? We can't ask as many questions as you might have heard from Dr. Tworeg, who had more questions specific to the helpline. We have a limit of 99 questions, and a lot of those were simple prevalence questions. Nonetheless, we think we have some insight into what might attract youth to use the helpline. The California Helpline, for those of you who are not aware of it, is a free cessation counseling service, and there are up to 6 sessions of behavioral counseling available to any caller, and it's available to anybody in California with a phone, so access should be easy. Unfortunately, it only reaches 2-4% of Californians. And part of it is the lack of marketing, as has been alluded to in the main experience. The survey design was a complicated design, stratified by 12 regions, and it was school-based. So we account for that in our analyses. We ended up getting 87% of our schools to participate. We used the elbow strategy. By saying, if you want to accept tobacco control monies, it's conditional on your willingness to participate in the survey. So that has helped get a yes from the schools. There were some exceptions, some small rural schools that get relatively little in absolute amounts in terms of tobacco control monies, found it easier to say no, despite the fact that earlier they had said, yes, we agreed to this condition. Student participation was also relatively high, in part because by this time we were able to use passive consent with 75% of the schools. When you have an active permit procedure where the parents have to actively sign a form, then we find it's not as easy to recruit the students. So the key question here is this one. Have you ever called the 1-800-NO-BUTS? That's our acronym. California Tobacco Hotline to help you quit. And the majority, of course, said, I have never smoked. But some did say that they smoked, and they also said they used a helpline. But you'll notice the number is very small, which is consistent with the experience that you heard earlier about Maine. Youth don't use the helpline much. Fortunately, our numbers were quite large. It was over 25,000 respondents. So we still had the end to examine prevalence of use of the quit line among smokers. We looked at both lifetime smokers and current smokers, and interestingly enough, we didn't find much of a difference in the propensity to use the helpline. It was a little over 4%. The percent of smokers saying yes to the to having used the California helpline did differ by gender. With, again, this was a surprise to me, and is in contrast to what you saw with adults using the main hotline, is that the males were more likely to use the quit line among current smokers only. When we looked by grade, I alluded to this earlier with one of my questions to Dr. Lazovich. We seem to find a propensity to use the helpline that is higher among the younger students. And this is a little puzzling, but I should say, and I don't have the data right here, that we found a similar trend towards increased quitting, regardless of whether they received assistance or not, among the younger students who smoked relative to older students who smoked. And I attribute that in part to the societal press to quit when almost all of your peers don't smoke, as is true in the 7th grade, as opposed to 12th grade, when a much higher proportion of your peers are using. And then we didn't find much in the way of ethnic differences in terms of use of the quit line. The one salient exception was African Americans, who were quite a bit more likely to use the helpline. Why that is a puzzle to me, so if anybody has a suggestion, I'd like to hear it. So now we want to ask the question, if the school provides cessation resources, and indeed, you know, close to a third did, does this influence subsequent use or concurrent use of the California helpline? There are some in the tobacco control community who said, you know, we aren't having much success in schools in helping kids to quit, so why don't we take the monies out of the schools and give it all to the California helpline, and maybe we'll have in aggregate a greater drop in smoking by redeploying our resources that way. And we have some interesting data that suggests we shouldn't be so quick to take this route. Maybe we shouldn't be reallocating the resources if we want our youth to be using the helpline. So does your school have special classes, cessation classes, for students who want to quit using tobacco? And for those who do or don't, what is the prevalence of the use of the helpline? What's interesting here is that, and it is statistically significant, although it's small, admittedly small, but nonetheless, it appears that those schools that offer cessation classes have a higher proportion of students reporting that they also have used the California quit line. So you had heard from previous speakers that probably the most significant influence on whether somebody uses the helpline is contact with a family member, neighbor, somebody who urges you to use the helpline. It's not ads, it's not a health professional. It's personal contact with somebody in your social network. And so it suggests to me that when you have people on campus in the schools actively promoting cessation, that they might also say for those students for whom the local resources are not enough, go use the California helpline. You know, they're out there to help you. So does your school have special classes? We already covered that question. And have you ever participated in any program? This is just the more generic question. Are you more likely to participate in any structured cessation program if your school offers resources to help you quit? And it's marginally non-significant, but there is a tendency for increased number of students saying yes to this question. If my school offers resources, am I likely to use any cessation resources, school-based or not? And the answer seems to be yes. And then finally, looking at numbers of times tried to quit, we related this to use of the helpline to give us a sense of how early in the cessation process. You know, most people to quit successfully need to quit multiple times before they succeed. So how early on in the smoking cessation process do these young smokers think to use the California quit line? And it's pretty apparent from the trends that you see here that this is not their first thought or even their second thought. They often will try 10 different attempts.
I think you moved back. I just moved you back up again.
Oh, okay.
So you're on the right slide.
Okay. Sorry about that. So it does suggest that whatever we can do to promote increased quitting will eventually cause increased use of the quit line. And so that's another argument for keeping some resources in the schools. Conclusion, investing tobacco control resources in school-based tobacco use treatment seems to be something that will promote more attempts at quitting, and more attempts at quitting in turn are likely to promote increased use of the California quit line. So the answer to the question by the policymakers, should we just get rid of all school-based programs and put all the money in the quit line? Don't know. And these are cross-sectional data, so as a researcher, I'm obligated to tell you that more research is needed. That's for my job security. But for the present time, given these data, my predilection is to keep some resources in the schools and, of course, to promote use of the California quit line as much as possible in the context of sharing resources across a variety of venues. Thank you. So I'm told I have a little bit of time for questions, so does the audience have any questions of me now that I've asked a few? Right, so the question is, what if we took the money out of the schools and actively put it into promoting the quit line among youth? Would that be a better alternative? And I think it's a great question. I don't know the answer. More research is needed. I suspect not, however, based on some of the evidence we've seen, that personal contact seems to be the best way of getting people, motivating people to use resources like the quit line. So as powerful as television might be, or radio ads, or billboards, even more powerful is face-to-face contact with somebody who's actively promoting the quit line. So on that score, you know.
You could imagine, like, flyers in every school, or, you know, what you were talking about, broadcasting the community level, I could imagine that being used to promote that campaign to the school level in a way that students have more access to it than perhaps what they might pick up when they're out in the community.
So rather than using a broadcasting method of reaching youth, if we had a more narrow casting method where we had flyers in their mailboxes or on their seats in every classroom, maybe that would be the way to increase youth use of the California quit line. And sounds like a great idea to me. I'm willing to test it if people want to give me the money. But absent good evidence that those narrow casting approaches do a better job than our current setup, I'm still a believer in school-based cessation. Yes?
Aside from the school-based program, how would particularly some of the younger youth be exposed to or hear about the quit line, in your opinion? What are some of the most common ways other than that they would even know about it?
My impression is that they hear an awful lot from family members, and many of the youth smoke in part because they have family members who are struggling with the tobacco addiction. And so doing more, say at the beginning of school, to educate parents about the appropriateness of not only they using the quit line, but their children as well, if their children happen to use tobacco, that might be an effective way. No, the quit line, for the most part, expects the audience to be over age 18. So almost, they do have some youth-oriented flyers, I believe, that are youth-oriented, but the vast majority of their marketing efforts have been targeted to adults. And that's partly, perhaps, in reaction to the fact that there are cessation resources at the school level. So why should the helpline invest more resources trying to attract youth when they think that the resources at the school level are adequate? And, you know, that turns out, since cessation is low among students, particularly in the higher grades at the school level, they're obviously going to need more help at some point. And it is true in California, and probably in many states elsewhere, that now the highest prevalence, when you look across the age spans, the highest prevalence of tobacco is now among the young adult population, you know, just out of high school. And so that tells you something about the lack of effectiveness so far in convincing young people to quit their habit. There is a question in the back.
I work for Senator
Neil Jones.
Great.
Yeah, do you want to describe to the audience what the gold card is?
The gold card is kind of a plastic, you know, very, it's not glittery. It's something that we can have for people that want to be globally, that have the 1-800 but hotline on there for health. So we can hold out to people that want to know more about the situation.
It's the size of a credit card, right? So it looks like it has value, you know, or a telephone, a prepaid card. So yeah, those are attractive. They're a good marketing tool, and I think they continue to use it. But you're suggesting that we should use it more, is that it?
Maybe change the look of it. So it looks more,
For adults. Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. So some of the marketing efforts that are already successful with adults, if they were tailored more to the design interests of youth, might be more effective with youth as well. That's a great idea. Thank you. Over there on the left. Yeah, the California Tobacco Control Program has been a leader in examining special population groups, and the latest group that they added to their list was the low-income group, because they had been falling through the cracks, and the dropouts have also been falling in the cracks, inasmuch as we have school-based programs for the in-school youth, and then we have quit lines and other adult-oriented opportunities, but nothing really for the still youthful smokers who happen not to be in school. So it's very clear that we need to do a better job, and I believe the state is now investing more resources in trying to address those populations that in the past have been underinvested in. So thank you for that recommendation. Yes? There has been some training of the counselors in the helpline to deal with youth, but I'm sure there could be better tailoring. Most of the tailoring has been by ethnicity and less so by age. But in as much as it's harder for underage youth to have access to prescription pharmaceuticals designed to assist their cessation, that's one element that's going to be different from an adult. But obviously, if some of the policymakers were successful in moving some of the resources from schools to the helpline, then I think much more effort would be put into tailoring the messages. You know, for girls, for instance, focusing more on the weight control aspects that they associate with tobacco, and maybe a lesser concern to older women.
Okay. I just wanted to respond to your question about the work sites. What we are seeing in terms of who's asking for this program is about 60% are manufacturing companies. And what I hear from companies is, you know, we do have a helpline available through our insurance, but our employees really want like the idea of someone coming on site. They like that some of those manufacturing, smaller companies like a face-to-face approach. And so we really are getting to a variety of manufacturing type companies. Did I answer your question? Okay.
Are there any questions for any of the panelists? We have just a couple more minutes.
I had one for Carolyn.
Okay.
since I didn't have a chance to ask. There's a natural experiment that's taken place in Minnesota, and you seem to have the data, and I'd like to know if recruitment of smokers to your groups was enhanced by the institution of the workplace smoke-free law that was adopted in 2006, because you have a natural experiment. You were collecting data before, collecting data after. So tell us, you know, is it easier to get people to enroll in your classes as a result of now all workplaces being smoke-free?
I think that's a great question. What we have seen, because what happened actually before the ban is there were certain smaller ordinances that were passing, and whenever there was an ordinance in a smaller city or community, we would see a greater increase in the request for on-site tobacco cessation programming. Now, the year before the ban, the whole year prior to October 2007, we served 96 companies. So if you remember, to date there are 321. So that 1 year before the ban, we saw a spiked increase in companies that wanted to bring cessation activity to the work site. So yes, policy and cessation, I think, work hand in hand. The more restrictive the policy, the more we need to get help to the smoker who needs help quitting. So absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen the pattern elsewhere. It's just that we have fewer and fewer venues where anybody can smoke, adult or youth. We took a page out of the environmental movement, you know, which noticed that species were being extinguished by eliminating their habitat. So we're extinguishing the species smoker by eliminating any place where they can engage in the behavior. So that for the few youth who are still smoking, they tend to be doing poorly in school, and they tend to be more prone to violence. They get into fights more. They drink alcohol more. They're exhibiting sensation-seeking behaviors associated with all kinds of illicit drug use. So the pattern that we see is more and more closely resembling the pattern we've already seen for marijuana use and for other illicit drugs. So in some sense, we're turning tobacco slowly but surely into something seen as more forbidding, a substance, than it was in the 1950s when, you know, all men smoked, and that was the appearance. So the social acceptability of smoking is beginning to resemble the social acceptability of other substances. And so we see a pattern that confirms that. Yes? Yes, the question is, how much legitimacy do you have as a smoking cessation counselor if you yourself have never gone through the process of weaning yourself off of tobacco addiction? And I've been there since I've never been an addicted smoker, and I pretended to, you know, try to help them quit smoking. It's a good question, and you know, obviously when you try to recruit counselors, if the counselors are equal in all other respects, except some have experience as an addiction, as somebody who is addicted, I, as a person employing such individuals, would favor the person with that experience. But often you find that you can't get people with all that experience. they nonetheless have skills that will be helpful to the community. I, earlier in my career, had an opportunity to help the African-American community. You might notice I'm not African-American. I tried to enroll as a colleague, somebody on my campus who was African-American, but she provided some advice, but really was not part of the building of the materials. Eventually, we were helping pregnant African-American women using the WIC program. And it took us 5 years instead of the 1 year that it might have taken had I truly been a member of the community. But our program still was found sufficiently useful by the CDC that they recommended it as one of the programs that the nation should use to help pregnant women quit smoking. So I, by dint of using lots of focus groups, stakeholder interviews, getting as much input as possible from the community, I, even though I had no experience as an African-American, nonetheless was eventually able, after making some mistakes, to create materials that were maximally suitable, well-tailored for the African-American community. So that suggests to me that you don't have to have had direct experience with the behavior to know, especially after counseling many others with that behavior, what strategies might work for people who are subject to that addiction. So that's my roundabout explanation.
So I think,
totally agree. Thank you.
So we're out of time, but if anyone has any other questions for the panel, if any of you can stay up here for additional questions. But thank you all very much for coming.